Welcome to another episode of Skip and Telecast, a podcast about strategy, intelligence, and leadership. This episode is supported by EvaluServe, the company that makes it easier for your organization to make data-driven decisions through research, data analytics, and AI-powered products. I'm Cam Mackey with Skip. In today's episode, we talk with Peter Schwartz of Salesforce about scenario planning, the future of work, and how to provide fresh perspectives to one of the best connected CEOs in the world.
Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Peter Schwartz, who's Senior Vice President of Strategy and the Chief Futurist for Salesforce, where he manages the organization's ongoing strategic conversations around the world. Peter, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, in reading your bio, which we'll share with the show notes, you've got a really eclectic, fascinating background for our audience. You know, competitive intelligence geeks, they definitely want to talk about scenario planning. But you've also done some cool things being a script consultant on films like Minority Report. So you are the definition of a Renaissance man.
It was fun to do. I mean, look, my best-selling book is, a million copies over 20 years. A couple billion people saw Minority Report.
Hey, you know what? I'd take a million copies, though. That's pretty impressive. Well, one of the things that really caught my eye that, want to start the conversation today is around the pandemic, because it's, very real and immediate. And obviously, the last 2 years have been a wild ride, a lot of political, social upheaval, and other challenges as well. Now, you recently worked with Accenture Research and some other experts to develop scenarios for navigating this pandemic era. Could you maybe talk a little bit about some of the findings that you uncovered?
Sure. Look, I've been doing scenario planning for about 50 years, and almost exactly. I've been at Salesforce for 10 years just last week. In all of that time, I have never seen greater uncertainty than was introduced by the pandemic, particularly at the beginning. You know, at the beginning, we didn't know, would this mutate? Would it respond to a vaccine? Was a vaccine even possible against this? We didn't know how people would respond socially. We didn't know how governments would respond and so on. So there was an enormous amount of uncertainty, on top of which it was unique in one important characteristic. That is, it was sudden and global, right? March 2020, the world shut down. Now, we've never experienced anything quite like that, not even World War II. You know, World War II developed gradually over, and, maybe the birth of World War I, but even that, it was just marching in the, around Europe. There wasn't a whole lot happening in a lot of the rest of the world. So the truth is, this was quite unique in that respect. And we didn't know how the world would respond to that unique situation. So we began thinking about scenarios right at the beginning, because we had to advise our customers, our employees, our leaders about how the world might unfold. So in fact, the current set of scenarios is the fourth set that we've done. But now we're in a very different position. We have answers to some of those questions, though there are still very important uncertainties. We have, for example, we know that vaccines are possible, right? And that they work quite well. Yeah. But we also know now that there are a lot of people who will refuse to take the vaccine. We now know vaccines are possible, but we also know that it mutates. But we also know that governments have done are actually mostly the policy environment, the kind of response and support for the economies has been actually quite effective in much of the world. So, we've actually done most everywhere, mostly the right things, supporting renters and, being able to provide adequate unemployment insurance, all those kinds of things that have been very good. We also know that companies can actually redistribute their work and that lots and lots of people can work from home and many will not come back. But we also learned that there's a limit to the social dimensions of response. Eventually people get enough, I won't wear my mask, right. I won't socially distance, I do want to go to the football stadium, and so on, right?
Yeah.
So we've learned a lot over this last 2 years, and that shapes the scenarios going forward, because now we can actually say a little bit about the longer term, how this is going to evolve, how it'll begin to wind down, and what it looks beyond that. So that's what these three scenarios are about, because we now understand much more. So the first scenario we called uplift, and it's basically making the argument that all of those forces that I just talked about work out in mostly a positive direction. the vaccine continues to spread, that we do not get a major mutation, that the economic policy works remarkably well. And so, you know, a year from now, most people feel like in most of the world, the pandemic is over. Oh, by the way, an important part of the scenario is that we help vaccinate the world. We get vaccines everywhere, right?
Yep. Yep.
And then the economic policy begins to kick in, trade begins to take off. And we have, because we had such a massive stimulus and there's an enormous amount of pent-up demand and pent-up savings, right? People couldn't spend stuff. They want to go on trips. They want to go to the restaurant. They want to buy a new suit. They, you know, whatever it may be, they're ready to spend. And so that combination augurs well for as long as the pandemic is under control, mm-hmm. and that we'll see a major upturn in the economy over the next year or so. Where that could go wrong in the first instance is inflation.
Yeah.
That is, we've already seen a takeoff of inflation to some extent. Question, is that temporary or does it lock us into a new big wave of inflation? Now, unfortunately, we have one not good signal, sort of, which is the rise in energy prices, oil, gas, et cetera. In the late 70s, we went through something similar with a price increase, and it led to a takeoff and then a crash and then another takeoff. The crash came when the interest rates to suppress inflation went up to about 20%. All right. So
people don't want a 20% mortgage.
No.
Yeah.
And they don't take that mortgage. And so housing stops selling and so on. So, and that is exactly what happened in the period 1978, say 83. Could happen. We could see that same thing happen again. Right. That's the world where you see a dramatic rise in inflation and it takes off. And basically the central banks put the brakes on and you get a major downturn. So that's a plausible scenario. In that one, we've assumed that it is more difficult to get everybody vaccinated, but we do not have a variant that turns out to evade the vaccine.
Okay.
It's the scenario where the vaccine deniers persist and getting the world vaccinated does not move quickly. Mm-hmm. Third and final scenario is really shaped by geopolitics and evolution. The evolution is we do get a new variant, right? That evades our vaccine. So we need new vaccines, a whole new program of getting vaccinated. You know, we're back almost to ground zero on the, and that's a plausible scenario. As long as we don't get the world vaccinated and there's lots of room for evolution.
Exactly.
You know.
Nature takes course.
Yeah. The secondly, right now, as we know, there's an enormous amount of geopolitical tension in the world around a number of places, particularly around Taiwan. You know, it could get ugly. United States and China are interlinked. What happens if all of that has to tear apart and there's so much tension we can't trade with, we can't manufacture, they won't buy, we won't sell, you know, and the world economy begins to fragment
Absolutely.
Around the tension between the US and China, the two biggest economies on the planet by far. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, the EU is struggling too, and with the Russians and the Ukrainians and so on. And oh, we got Yemen and we got the Sudan and, you know, oh, and Nicaragua, let's not forget that. And the southern border of the United States.
Of course.
Right. So my only point in all of that is that geopolitics leads to a scenario we call fault lines, which is a combination of evolved virus coming back and geopolitics overwhelming any collaborative effort. This is a scenario that actually runs the risk ultimately even of conflict.
Like it is an armed conflict. That's when you say conflict. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is the, you know, potentially doomsday scenario then.
Not doomsday, but you know, look, Xi Jinping has said he wants to take China, take Taiwan back.
Taiwan back. Yes. Right.
And that he's prepared to use force if necessary. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
There are many arguments around all of this, mm-hmm. but there's at least a plausible scenario that some shooting starts over Taiwan. And that's not an implausible scenario today. And that would be really terrible for China, for US, for Taiwan, for the world.
Definitely. And one of the really great things about scenario planning is that it gives organizations, you know, just flexibility. You get to think about these various scenarios coming to pass, and you can think through, you know, what are the threats and opportunities for strategy in there. And so there's one thing you mentioned I want to pick up on, Peter, and that's this, you know, shift towards working from home or, you know, not working in the office all the time. Obviously just one of the pieces you talked about. So, you know, how do employers think about this? Because this really, especially here in the States, flies against a lot of corporate cultures. Do you see this, maybe not snapping back to normal, but how do you see this dynamic playing out from a employing, you know, HR perspective?
We're not going back to the old world.
Okay.
That world is gone. Mm-hmm. Offices will still exist. Many people will still go to the office. I was just talking to one of my colleagues in Sydney just a couple hours ago. And he says, yeah, my plan, he was actually called, today was the first day the office is open. No, yesterday, pardon me.
Oh, okay.
Sydney, right? In the Salesforce office. And he was saying, well, his plan is to work from home 3 days a week. And I mean, 2 days a week and come to the office 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. I think that will be quite common.
Yeah.
And that the balance will shift. You know, if before there, we had always had like 20% of our employees who worked just from home. If you're a programmer in Kansas, you don't need to go to the office. If you're a salesperson in the middle of Missouri, you don't have an office to go to. You're selling to companies in St. Louis and so exactly. on. Yep. You're not from an office.
Yep. You're on the road.
Yeah. Having said that, it will now be probably close to half the workers who almost never come to the work office. Almost never. Another maybe quarter who come occasionally. And another quarter who come most of the time. It'll be some spread like that. But I think we've made a fundamental shift. We've learned, you know, I used to go to the office about 3 days a week, sometimes four. It was a 45 minute commute each way. So that's an hour and a half a day. I've gained all that back.
Yeah.
You know, that matters a lot to me.
Absolutely.
And it, you know, and we've looked, and the tools of collaborative work mm-hmm. are changing fundamentally. When we started the pandemic, none of us had ever done a Zoom before, had we?
I remember those days fondly, right?
Yeah, Google Hangouts.
Yep, maybe. Sure.
Microsoft Teams didn't exist.
Yep, right.
So what has happened is that the pandemic has set in motion a huge wave of innovation mm-hmm. of all the tools of remote engagement. The other day, I did my first Clubhouse conversation.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah, that's
about
fun.
About topping asteroids, right? Clubhouse didn't exist. Right. So we've just got tons of new ways of working and collaborating remotely. Salesforce bought Slack for that reason. Right.
Yep.
Enabling the remote worker everywhere to be able to work as if he were at home at the office is our goal. Right. Mm. So the answer is it's a fundamental change. Having said that, most companies like Salesforce will make efforts to try to sustain support, grow, develop, deepen the culture. Yeah. In our case, one of the things we've announced, and it's nothing special or unique, is we're going to build what we call Salesforce Ranch, a place where our employees can come together with their families and communities
nice.
For learning and social experience and so on, that will be a place that where we inculcate our values. Mm-hmm. New employees will go there for onboarding and things like that. So you'll have to come up with new mechanisms to compensate for the fact that most people will not be in the office. Look, there are many employees, but during the pandemic, we've hired so far, oh, by now, last time I checked, it was 15,000, and that was about a month or so ago. So wow. maybe putting, I don't know, 17,000, 18,000 employees during the pandemic who've never been to the office, who've never seen a fellow employee, except maybe if they went to a Starbucks or something and hung out there, right?
Accidental, yeah.
Right? So yeah, we've got senior officers that I've never met any of their friends. We've got one guy who came and went in a high-level job. No, I'm serious. You know, he was
if you told someone this 10 years ago, they wouldn't believe it. They would just think, ah, no.
He was hired during the pandemic. Nobody had ever seen him. And he's gone.
My goodness. Well. So, I mean, and that raises an interesting issue. I mean, obviously, you talked, Peter, about the technological you know, implications of this, you know, all the cool collaborative stuff. And you talked about Salesforce Ranch, which is, you know, maybe less technology, but like, holy moly, managers got to really approach their roles differently.
Yes,
do you see companies are evolving, you know, sure. their awareness of that and given the support to managers?
Yes. Look, I mean, it is a new realm of management. How do you manage a remote worker? How do you evaluate a remote worker? How do you provide feedback to a remote worker? How do you promote a remote worker, et cetera? Yeah. And that will be a whole new set of management, both procedures, mm-hmm. practices, learnings. Because the truth is, to some extent, we've had a fair amount of that in a variety of contexts. Remote sales forces, right?
Sure.
That's not a unique situation. That's a fairly common sale. So we've had a bit of experience with that in the past that we can learn from. But having said that, we're going to learn a lot. There's going to be experimentation. We'll get some things wrong, something. But within, I don't know, call it a year or so, most people who manage a large number of remote workers will have kind of both gotten and learned the necessary skills. If they were a good manager before,
yes, right,
probably be a good manager again.
Yes.
If they were an inept manager before, the new skills won't help.
It's probably even worse now. It's worse now. Well, what one last issue on we could talk about the virtual world forever. Maybe I should say the metaverse. But so as we think about us as consumers, right? Both as you and I going getting some coffee from Starbucks, say, but also in the B2B context where Salesforce really sings, like. Is everything going to be a virtual purchase experience now, or do in-person physical experiences still matter?
It's a yes and.
Okay.
So yeah, a lot of things can and will be done virtually mm-hmm. that were done face-to-face before. However, relationship building, all those things that require some degree of empathy mm-hmm. will, I think, learning about a customer, mm-hmm. Let us say that before the balance was 80% face-to-face and 20% virtual. Now it'll be closer to, call it 60% virtual and 40% face-to-face. Mm-hmm. You'll still want to go out to dinner with that favored customer or somebody you're trying to develop. I remember one day I was visiting a customer to do a presentation. I won't say which one, and the account executive arrived with me to do the presentation. And what did he arrive with? Big tray of bagels, cream cheese, and coffee, right?
Nice.
And people were there for the bagels.
Not of course. It's free food,
Free food, yeah. Right? Well, that doesn't work too well online.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. No, it's, and we all tried that during, the last year. We, mailed care packages and the like, and it's nice, right? But so there is that physical hook there. As consumers, we get it, Peter. And I guess, thinking through what does this mean for businesses, right? And I want to circle back on scenario planning because it's, something where, you literally wrote the book on it. As a tool, as a management tool for companies to think through these issues and how it might play out, not just from their own talent, but thinking about competitive threats, opportunities for new value propositions, how can scenario planning help organizations through a crazy time like this?
Look, the very craziness is what demands scenario planning. There's still huge uncertainties, as I suggested in the three mm-hmm. scenarios that we laid out yet. Mm-hmm. So the uncertainties are still quite profound. And look, you can do scenario planning at a variety of depths. All it really means is contingent thinking, thinking through the possibilities and asking yourself, what would I do if? Now, you can do that with a lot of fanfare and a lot of research and a lot of support and a sophisticated team and do it in a fairly complex way. But the basic process is you're kind of thinking about your problem, looking at how the world around you might affect that problem and the different ways it might turn out. The most important thing is challenging your own assumptions, mm-hmm. is asking yourself the hard, awkward questions you don't want to ask. What if, what if my biggest customer goes bankrupt in this environment, right? Mm-hmm. Can happen. What if the supply chain gets all screwed up and I can't get my key components?
Exactly.
What could possibly happen?
Never.
Right. Never. So it is basically, and it can be done, as I said, in a more or less sophisticated version. And the honest truth is we kind of intuitively do it a lot anyway, right? A good business manager's asking themselves the kind of what if questions. It's just doing it a bit more thoughtfully and more rigorously. And look, the goal is not getting the future right. The goal is getting the decision right, making a better decision. If you get the future right, and you made a good decision. That's a success.
Yeah.
Getting the future right and ignoring it. That's a failure.
That's a big failure. Yeah. And so I want to pick up on that because I love your approach where it doesn't have to be such a massive process, with a 6-inch thick planning books, you've probably seen that not work well, but what do you see as stumbling blocks? Because a lot of companies either don't do scenario planning or they really don't do it well. What are some of the mistakes you see organizations make with scenario planning?
Well, the single biggest mistake is a lack of diversity and perspective. Yeah. Every time I've gotten the future badly wrong, it's because I was just talking to myself. the team that we brought together to do it knew each other, didn't challenge each other's assumptions, didn't ask the hard, awkward questions. And so that is the single biggest thing. Is making sure that as you do this conversation, and I think of it as a kind of strategic conversation among the leadership of the company, you need to make sure there's adequate diversity. There's somebody in the room who's going to say, wait a minute, maybe that's wrong. Maybe the price of that commodity is not going to fall. Maybe it's going to rise. Maybe that technology that we were counting on is going to take two more years. Maybe, you know, whatever it may be,
right, so
the real issue, let me give you a concrete example that history is all clear about. They gave me the data. Look, in 1980, a small group of white men in Boca Raton was considering the future of a new product for IBM. It was called the personal computer.
I've heard of these guys. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And their forecast was, over 5 years, selling 240,000 units, with a peak in 1983, falling to zero by 1986 because nobody would buy a second one. Why? Because it was so puny that basically it was a useless product. It was intended to kill Apple. It was not intended to create a new product line. How many personal computers does IBM make today?
Zilch.
Zilch. Yeah. How many are sold in the world today?
A whole lot.
How many hundred million a day?
Yeah, exactly.
This group of men who all thought alike convinced themselves that there was no future for this product. And IBM literally lost its future in that moment. That's the single biggest mistake you can make, is to actually make, you know, convince yourself that you've got a good worldview and have nobody to challenge it.
Yeah.
And I'll say, I've done it myself.
Oh, sure.
Every time I regret it in hindsight.
Well, I love that because, I mean, you know, we can be our own worst enemy at times. And it's good but humbling to hear you say that. So, so, you know, one of the, you know, the great assets of a company like Salesforce, when you have this big global workforce, right, you know, all different backgrounds, how do you kind of leverage some of their fresh perspectives, their, you know,
We have a mechanism for that.
Oh, okay.
We run something called the Futures Lab. And the Futures Lab, one of my colleagues actually who's worked with me for 25 years, all the way back to Global Business Network and so on, and joined me at Salesforce about 5 years ago to create a Futures Lab to do just what you've asked. And that is we hold meetings around the world, workshops. Where typically it's between a dozen and 20 or so, mostly Salesforce employees, though we always bring in one or two outsiders for the diversity. We spend a day thinking together about the future. And it basically, we have a set of tools we've developed over the years, Lynn Carruthers, my colleague, that are designed to evoke ideas about the future from these people and create a great conversation among them so they can build and synthesize on each other ideas. And so we've been doing that for years. It's basically modeled on what we did in Global Business Network before I did before I started at Salesforce. We ran a process like that, which we called Worldview, and we got people together to do exactly that. But in this case, we're tapping not a network of thinkers around the world and customers, but Salesforce people.
Wow. And so I can imagine that you probably have some really rich conversations in the moment. And then how does that, you know, filter up or down or sideways into, you know, the senior leadership doing scenario planning or, you know, any kind of strategy?
Several ways. Okay. It's different today than it was at the beginning. At the beginning, we didn't have Slack. We had Chatter and Quip. Mm-hmm. So we have internal distribution systems for sharing ideas. Mm-hmm. In addition, part of my responsibility and several other people on our team is to participate in and present in a variety of company fora, you know, product planning meetings, sales kickoff, things like that, right?
Yeah.
And at all of these meetings, me and my team and people who've been part of that process will present ideas on things that have been coming out of this that are relevant to our considerations. So we use the digital distribution system as well as participation in the kind of ongoing intellectual life of the company.
Which is fantastic because it's kind of like a thousand flowers bloom approach where it you really get the fresh perspectives, you engage the employees. It's a fascinating approach. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen a lot at Skip is the need. Leaders don't want the episodic intelligence reports that you get once a quarter or, you know, it's just the world doesn't operate that way. I think, you know, you mentioned very well that we've never had more uncertainty. And so, you know, our audience, Peter, they're insights geeks, you know, competitive intelligence, market intelligence, you know, how do you, you know, what do you need from those types of people in order to plan strategy, to think about the future, to help Salesforce be successful? How's that changed?
Well, let me put it in a slightly wider context. Mm-hmm. I have a CEO, Mark Benioff, who is brilliant. He is a business giant and moral giant who has himself an enormous network of extremely interesting connections and sources of intelligence that feed him. Mm-hmm. Okay. My challenge is, can I do anything beyond what he already gets?
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. No, so you're maybe a little unique then in that regard, okay?
Well, there are a lot of brilliant, you know, you should assume that, you know, that the challenge is that hard. You should assume that everybody's working for Mark Benioff. He just came from Glasgow, from the COP26.
Oh, yeah, COP26,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, where he was with, you know, there's a great picture of him, John Kerry, and Prince William chatting, right?
Wow. Okay. How do you make it into that crowd? That's impressive.
Exactly. So that's it. He's on the board of directors of the World Economic Forum, Davos, right? Yeah. So any head of state, royalty, CEO will talk to him. Every academic on the planet will send him papers. Every newspaper editor will send him editorials, and so on, right? Yeah. So my challenge is to be ahead, is to be unique, is to provide extremely distinctive insight that he may not find elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is that all the conventional sources are almost all irrelevant. Yeah. If I say, I mean, I read the FT and I love The Economist, best thing in the world, yep. Right? I read both of them religiously. But I have to get beyond that, because he will get the FT articles. He will get The Economist article. He will get the report from an interesting conference somewhere of a general sort. I have to dig deeper. I have to get out more to the fringe. I have to get out a little bit further into the future. I have to get into things that are a little less clear and, you know, not likely to be on the newspaper front page yet. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge, you know, that to get at those things that a really smart, very well-informed senior business executive will not be able to get at easily themselves.
Yeah. So you're hunting for, you know, the needle in the haystack, or, you know, the diamond in the rough, whatever analogy you want to use. And so do you find that those nuggets, Peter, are going to be more likely to come from those conversations you have, whether it's internally with your colleagues or, you know, one of your biggest customers? Is that where you're going to get at some of those ideas that Mark doesn't already have in his ear?
Yes, and. Well, no, all that, everything you just said is true. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But I would add that over the years, what I've developed is a network of really interesting and remarkable thinkers around the world, mm-hmm. scientists, artists, poets, writers, filmmakers, etc., yeah. who see things that others will not see. I'll give you a concrete example of the value of such a person. Mm-hmm. That is, I in the very first project I ran for when we started Global Business Network was for AT&T. Mm-hmm. And they were our first and stayed our customer throughout, huge customer. And this was the old AT&T. This was AT&T in the late 1980s.
Oh, Ma Bell. Yeah, okay.
Well, this was, they had just started breaking up.
Oh, okay.
Having said that, the only point is that the project was on the future of the information movement and management industry is what they called it, IM&M, right? Okay, so we're looking at the future scenarios for the evolution of the whole information industry. And we hold a scenario planning workshop at MIT. Hmm. We bring in interesting outsiders to be stimulating thinkers. And one of the people we brought in was a guy named Peter Gabriel.
Peter Gabriel.
The rock star.
Yeah.
Yeah, that rock star.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Who happens to be one of my closest friends. And Peter, on the other hand, is a master of understanding arts, information, and technology.
Interesting.
Okay. So during the workshop, one of the AT&T executives said, this is just when CDs were coming to market. It just started being distributed, right? Mm-hmm. So we now had perfect digital copies. And one of the executives asked Peter during the workshop, so Peter, now that anybody can get a perfect digital copy of your music, how are you going to deal with piracy? And piracy had not even developed yet.
Yeah. That's a prescient question right there.
Yes. Yeah. And Peter had the prescient answer. He says, we will not be able to stop it. So the business model will change. I will make my living on concerts not selling DVDs.
He said that in
1988.
That is remarkable.
And it went step further. I will treat piracy as free advertising. And therefore, I will actually, wherever they're pirating my DVDs, I will follow it with concerts.
Wow. That's absolutely remarkable, because that, you know, at least 15 years before, you know, that actually happened.
10 years. You know, okay. By the mid-90s, that was becoming...
Yeah, Napster.
Yeah. Yep, by the mid-90s, it was becoming clear. Even before Napster, if you were in the music business, you know, you're unless you had a mega... Anyway, my only point is, 1988, Peter Gabriel sees the future business model. Even before the modern internet is born, before the World Wide Web is born, he sees it, right? So... that's the kind of insight you're looking for.
Yeah, I love that, because it's like you say, if you go to the usual suspects, you get the usual answers. And so I love your comment about, you know, being inclusive, bringing in the artists and, you know, the scientists. And maybe, you know, the last issue I want to touch on you with is the role of business in society. And this has been an ongoing dialogue around the world. I think the business roundtables have taken some nice positions on it. You know, World Economic Forum has had some forward thinking. I would just love your perspective as we're coming out of this pandemic at whatever pace we are. What responsibility do businesses have, you know, through the recovery and beyond to society?
Look, for me, the answer is really obvious. The idea that a major institution does not have responsibility for the evolution of the society in which it exists is bloody stupid. You know, no offense. You know, that's like saying I get to be a citizen, but I have no responsibility. No, of course you do. You know, it's not an option. It's not a question. The only question is what the nature of that responsibility is, how far to go with it. But the idea that somehow or other the only responsibility that business has is to provide shareholder return was always a really, really stupid idea. As brilliant as Milton Friedman was, that was fundamentally wrong. It was acontextual. It's as if business operates in a vacuum, right? But business depends upon infrastructure. Business depends upon laws. Business depends, there's a vast number of highways and roads and so on. And to imagine that, for example, it has no responsibility in that is ridiculous, okay? So now the question becomes, what is the responsibility? And it depends on the nature of the business and the scale, but it is to pay attention to all the people that you connect with, all the stakeholders, whether it's your employees or your customers or your communities or the environment, everything that you are connected to, you need to think about. And what is your responsibility and impact on those? If, for example, you're producing a great deal of pollution, you are impacting the planet and the health of people around you. You might ask yourself a question, is that a good idea, right? And maybe I can do something about that. But that's, this is not profound. Right. The idea that you should take responsibility for the consequences of what happens in a community of which you're part.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not profound, but it also is, right? I mean, because I think, you know, we, you know, not a knock against capitalism at all, but, you know, unfettered capitalism where it's all about, you know, stakeholder value is, we've seen that that has limits and it has real impacts on society.
Well, no offense. I joined Salesforce 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Our stock price was $20 a share. Okay. It closed today at $308.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if companies were listed by their best values and how they behave socially, Salesforce is up there as number one, two, or three on the planet.
Yeah.
Shareholder return, multiple of 15. Delivering on social values, 100%. Yeah. These are not in conflict. These right. are not in conflict. You can be a company that delivers on everything for the shareholder. Oh, and by the way, we had 3,000 employees. We have 70,000 employees. Okay, when I joined, it was three. Now it's 70. All right. Now, job creation, a very good thing.
Yeah.
This is what's called capitalism. We made a whole lot of money for our shareholders. We created a vast a number of jobs. We provided a great value to our customers. And oh, by the way, we've paid attention to the environment, to equality, to human rights, all of those things, and been a leader. There is no conflict between these.
No. Well, it's taking advantage of your scale and your technical know-how. It's your culture. And as you grow, I mean, you can have a greater positive impact on all the various communities that you serve. It runs counter to the big business is bad narrative, which I think just is exactly. Just so reductionist.
Well, and look, let me be also perfectly clear. This is all happening because we have a great CEO and his leadership. And now he's brought other leaders around him who share that and so on, who are his partners in it. It's not a one man band, but it begins with the most senior leadership setting the standard.
Peter Schwartz, thank you for a dynamite conversation. Really appreciate you joining us here today. Any parting words before we let you get back to the amazing work that you do?
Well, look, I'm an optimist about the future. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I weren't. I am enormously impressed with human progress. At the beginning of the last century, I'd be dead by now. But, average lifespan 39. I'm 75. And my tennis game has never been better.
Love it. Love it.
My sense is that I'm enormously optimistic about the future.
Well, fantastic. Peter, thank you. Here's to many more years of successful tennis and helping make the world a better place. Really appreciate you talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Skip and Telecast. For best practices, conversations, and training about strategy intelligence, visit skip.org.